We're delighted to welcome all of you here this evening to this co-sponsored event with the Thomistic Institute, which is run out of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Diocese of Arlington's Office for Family Life. And it's a great pleasure to be here in the Diocese of Arlington. My name is Father Dominic Legg. Father Thomas Joseph White is just to my left. I'm the Assistant Director for the Thomistic Institute. This event is part of a new initiative of the Thomistic Institute to bring some of what we do at the Dominican House of Studies, the theology of Thomas Aquinas and dialogue with contemporary questions, out to an engagement with the contemporary world in the greater Washington, D.C. area. And so we've been having a number of events on the other side of the river but with our D.C. Young Professionals chapter, and now we're very happy to be on this side of the river as well to listen to Father Thomas Joseph White. But before I introduce Father White, I just wanted to say a brief word about the work of the Thomistic Institute and the ways that we, in sort of surprising ways, have been growing, not only in academic conferences that we put on at the Dominican House of Studies, but now in on secular campuses where we are running events just like this this year in 8 different locations, including a number of the Ivy League universities, Brown, Harvard, Yale, UVA, NYU, Columbia, and some other places. And we would love to make more connections with engaged Catholics in those places. So I imagine many of you may know some undergraduates or graduate students on Catholic campuses that might be interested in having programs like this on their campus. We would love to hear from you. We would love to meet some of those students and find a way to expand this program and bring it to more places. We also would love to have you on our mailing list so that you would know about our upcoming events. And so we actually didn't have enough of these forms, but on every other chair, there should be a form like this. So if you're already on our mailing list, give your form to somebody sitting next to you. But if you fill out this form, we will add you to our email list, which we do not sell or share with other people. And then you can drop it in the box, which is underneath the table right over to the side here, and we will add you so that you're up to date. So our theme for this evening is beauty. Beauty in art, beauty in liturgy, and bringing the wisdom of Aquinas to bear on that question. And our speaker this evening is Father Thomas Joseph White. Father White is the director of the Thomistic Institute. He teaches on our pontifical faculty. He has a doctorate in theology from Oxford University and is a graduate of Brown University. He is a man who is very much tuned in to beauty because he plays all kinds of music, sometimes not as beautifully as the rest of us would like, perhaps. He's a banjo player, a mandolin player, a mandola player. So if you get to know Father Thomas Joseph very well and you serve him just the right thing to drink, you might be able to get him to play a little banjo music for you. Speaking to us this evening, Can Beauty Save the World? Aquinas on Art and Liturgy.
Thank you very much, Father Legg. He is confusing himself with me because I end up obeying him so much. And one of the reasons it's dangerous to be a Catholic religious is they tell you to do things under obedience you're not really warranted to do, like give talks on beauty when your formation is in theology. So an apology to those who in particular hope for a focus on art. There's a section in this talk on art, so I will go there, but what I really want to begin with is being. Before there was the beauty of art, there's the beauty of the world. The world is beautiful. Reality is beautiful. And in a certain way, everything that exists, just insofar as it exists, is beautiful. That's Thomas Aquinas' radical claim. And one of the things that's so powerful about Aquinas' mind is he can give you a short, pithy definition of something that applies, when you understand it rightly, to a massively extensive universal field of knowledge. So his definition of beauty, strangely, is so flexible and so penetrating, it works for every facet of reality. And that is exactly his claim, is that when rightly understood, when you understand what beauty is, you see how beauty is in all things. So I'm going to start with that before I move eventually to artistic beauty as a kind of beauty, and then hone in on liturgy. And then I'll try to answer that famous question from the Dostoevsky novel, The Idiot, Can Beauty Save the World?, where an interlocutor says to Prince Mushkin that it scribes to him to have once said that beauty can save the world. Did you say that, Prince? And then he says to him, you only say that because you're in love, and you also say it because you're a Christian. It's an interesting claim that love for others ascribes the belief that beauty can save them. And Dostoevsky himself once said in a letter, I think in the 1880s, that the most infinitely beautiful thing is Jesus. And in the book, the idiot, the prince, who is in his innocence, practices empathy and compassion and love for persons in a very chilling and often evil world, is a archetype of Christ, or a foreshadowing of Christ, whose infinite beauty can save the world. So Thomas Aquinas gives one of these pithy definitions of beauty in the Summa Theologiae when he's talking about the beauty of Jesus, actually, the beauty of the Eternal Son. So it's in a theological context, but he gives a metaphysical definition, and that's where we're going to start, with metaphysics. What is it to say something's beautiful? And he has this famous quote, which I've given you here. For beauty includes three conditions: integrity, or perfection, since those things which are impaired are by that very fact ugly; due proportion, or harmony — the word in Latin is consonantia, which is like consonants, harmony — and lastly, brightness, or claritas, clarity, sometimes defined as splendor, whence things are called beautiful which have a bright color. Nice Italian phrase. By the way, if you go in 13th century Italian churches, then you cannot be confused about whether Catholicism is a dour religion, because they're so flooded with color. All the icons and paintings are colorful. That's high medieval Italian Catholicism. So anyway, that should prove something to those who are thinking. Anyway, so let's focus in on these three terms: integritas, proportio, claritas. So let me take a simple example to illustrate. Take a beautiful tree. I was out at Thomas Aquinas College in California in January, and I'm sure some of you know that place, and in the middle of the quad outside the absolutely gorgeous church, they had this Tolkien-esque tree. It's magnificent, that sits in the middle of the campus quad. So if you think about integrity, put in your mind's eye the most beautiful oak tree you know of, or maybe if you're a southerner, you can think of a dogwood tree, or whatever it is that appeals to you. And there's a wholeness to a tree, first of all, so there's a certain integrity. Integritas, or perfection, has to do with a wholeness of the form. Think about if they're building telephone lines in that area and they saw off the branches of the tree, it's mutilated. And so there's a lack of integrity. The form has lost its wholeness. Or think about when we look at a person who's come back from Afghanistan or Iraq and lost an appendage, and we think about how the human form has been harmed and maimed, and we consider their sacrifice heroic because they've offered up, you know, they've made a sacrifice that's touched the very integrity of their body. Okay, so the fundamental basis for beauty is the wholeness of the form, the perfection of an integrity of the form. And then there's proportio. Proportio is a set of relationships between quantity and between qualities. So if you think about the branches of the tree, there's a certain quantity of branches, and they're in a certain proportionate relationship to each other. They're sort of sprouting out in all directions. Think about those strange trees that for some reason or another have only grown on one side. You know, maybe they're in a windy tundra in northern Scotland. So the trees have all, the branches have all grown out on one side. They're interesting, but they're not as beautiful. So there's a certain physical quantitative proportion in the way the branches have outstretched. And then there's the integration of the qualities. So that's the relation of the quality of the colors, for example. Think about the various colors of the tree. The trunk has various colors, the leaves have colors, the flowers have colors. So you have a triad of colors often. And they're proportioned to each other, not only in quality, but then in physical space. You see what's happening? You've got a kind of holistic shape or perfection that's manifest through this proportionate quantity of different branches, this proportionate qualities, relationship of qualities, and then what emerges is splendor, claritas, the beauty of the form. So claritas is a kind of a crowning achievement of a given thing. I'm going to give many more illustrations, but I just think I agree with old J.R. Tolkien that if you look at trees, I mean, he walked a lot through Magdalen Gardens in Oxford, and there's a lot of beautiful trees there. And so they play a very important role in Lord of the Rings, where he's trying to think about primal archetypes of beauty. And trees are beautiful. It's interesting. They catch our mind's eye, and we do like to take walks and contemplate them. And they perfectly illustrate that kind of a threefold characteristic of beauty. So you say, okay, good, Aquinas understands beautiful trees. But then he understands this to be an analogical concept, meaning that's coextensive with being. That's to say, everything that exists is in some way, you can attribute this definition to it. And I'm going to explore that idea now. Having given the basic definition, how can we think about looking at the whole range of being and thinking about the beauty of reality? Now, when he talks about transcendental notions, Aquinas means notions that transcend specific categories of kinds of things, like a dandelion, a kangaroo, a star, an aardvark, a water molecule, a human being, a baseball cap. Okay, those are all specific kinds of things. But then there's stuff that's true about all those things in all their randomness and strangeness and diversity. They all exist. They all have being. And then he says there's certain things, once a thing is, just because it is, there's other characteristics that we attribute to it transcendentally, like a certain kind of unity. Now there's diverse unities. The unity of a baseball cap is very different than the unity of a kangaroo, is very different than the unity of a star, is very different than the unity of a single note of the organ playing out through the air. Okay? But there's always some unity. And then he says, because those things exist and have unity, they have intelligibility. Everything that exists is in some way potentially intelligible. And that's the transcendental truth. There's reality and truthfulness in things. Is it true that there are kangaroos? Is it true that there are baseball caps? Are baseball caps, kangaroos, stars, aardvarks, water molecules, and human beings real? Yes. Is the unicorn real? No. It's really a fictional image. It's a really beautiful medieval image. But it's not real, a real thing. Okay. When you have being and unity, you have truth. What's really real? What's true? And insofar as the thing is and has being, it can be known, it can be appetible. That's to say, it can be desired or loved in its goodness. And there's all kinds of grades of goodness. Right? So if you were to take a Yankees baseball cap and wear it through Boston, right, it would be very different. And now, you know, reactions about like whether that's a good thing, depending whether you're there or in Manhattan. Nobody in Manhattan would care, incidentally, but it takes a great act of courage to wear that baseball cap in Boston. It's good for the Bostonians, too. But anyway, all right, so appetibility enters into things, the goodness of things. And we'll come back to this, but the human being is capable of loving the goodness of things in diverse ways. I mean, the goodness of, you know, a close friend, or the goodness of a parent, our mother or father who loves us, is very different than the goodness of a food that keeps us alive, or the goodness of wine, which we appreciate for its ceremonial and fraternal joy that it facilitates, right? So there's a lot of diverse ways in which things are good. The goodness of a painting as opposed to, you know, is that a good sweater? Yeah, it's a very good sweater. It like, really keeps me warm in Rhode Island in the winter. Okay, so goodness is a very plastic notion, but it enters into being. This is where we locate beauty. Aquinas thinks that beauty is in a certain way, he calls it sometimes the splendor of the form or the appetibility of the truth, the attractiveness of the truth of a thing. Now, it's the attractiveness of the truth of a thing in precisely what I was talking about before. When you take integrity, proportion, and splendor, okay, so let's go back to the tree. The tree we were talking about, this beautiful oak tree you have in your mind.
it has a certain perfection, integrity, it has these proportionate features, it has this splendor. Is that real? Is it truly thus that it is beautiful? Yes. And then there's the attraction of that truth, the way that that invites the mind to gaze contemplatively upon the beauty of the thing. Now that's a sensate example of beauty. I'm going to give some examples of spiritual beauty. The fact of the matter is that the integral form, the perfection of the form, draws the human being out to gaze or wonder or contemplate in admiration and attraction. Okay, so maybe you are in a parish in Arlington on a Sunday, and the organist, after the priests have proceeded out, does one of those, lets the tiger out of the cage, and he does one of those extraordinary solo. Maybe he's doing Bach or something, and some of you sit there and you listen to the whole thing. You forget to thank God that you've just taken the Holy Eucharist, and you are enraptured by the beauty of the music. And it's wonderful, okay? But there's a certain admiratio, because there's a splendor, there's an integrity, there's proportion between all the notes, there's a kind of a wholeness to it, and when it's finished, you applaud. There's a kind of affection, a love for the splendor of the form of the music you've just heard. So you see how plastic the concept is? You can apply it to the Bach piece after Mass, you can apply it to the tree. Okay. So beauty enters into all things. Now I'm going to give illustrations of this, moving up what I'm going to posit to be the chain of being, starting from non-living things and moving to living things and then up to human things and then talk about God and Christ. So take a snowflake. A snowflake is an easy example. I'm going to give lots of easy examples because I'm not, I want to be certain to succeed in making the metaphysical idea realistic. So, you know, you can go online now. There's some really nice things about computers. One is you can ask National Geographic to show you 1,000 snowflakes. And that sounds really maybe sentimental, but they're fascinating. You know, everyone is unique, and there's all these arguments about why that is, and scientists study it. But they're all gloriously integral, beautifully proportioned, and splendid. And, I mean, Aquinas couldn't see that. He didn't have the microscope. But now we can illustrate the truth of the metaphysical principles he enunciates by looking at, you know, clicking on the computer and looking at 100 snowflakes. This is how you distract yourself when you have to prepare a talk on beauty. You know, but maybe it's not such a bad distraction, right? You can explain to your boss why you're not, well, I'm enjoying the beauty of reality. I'm just clicking on the snowflakes. But I mean, it is the natural world has a certain, so that's a very easy example, and you could say, well, what about, you're going to say things, well, what about the spider? Okay, but we can talk about evil maybe in the Q&A. Evil does have a certain kind of, there's such a thing as, there are beautifully seductive forms of evil, and they're very, most of the time, however, evil, whether natural or moral evil, has a certain ugliness to it. In fact, always. The Grand Canyon, okay, if you stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, you look at it, it's very different, but you have, if you can see the sort of periphery of the canyon's edge, there's a certain integrity there, and then you can look at the proportion of all the lines of quantitative lines of erosion, and all the colors, and all the incredible complexity of the vegetation, and it's the sublimity of it. I mean, it's just the magnitude of it, quantitatively, and the vast detail, the fact that your mind's eye can gaze into it, like almost an ocean of complexity, and there is a certain sublime splendor to the Grand Canyon. That's why people go there and they look out at the edge of it, because it shows you something in the physical world, not alive, but just magnificent. There's a magnificence to it. So those are some easy examples. If we move up the chain of being, think about a vegetative living thing like a rose. Okay, we give those away to people to symbolize affection. But if you kind of transcend romantic sentiment for a minute and just look at it, actually, it's quite incredible, the sort of vegetative complexity. Okay, a rose, it's an easy example again, but it's got this perfection to it. If it's timed rightly, depending on when it was, you know, a mature rose and when it was cut and how it's been harvested, it has a certain very beautiful proportion of the petals and a magnificent, splendid form. Okay. The redwood forest, that's a more complex example. Take a single redwood, it's almost disproportionate. Of course, it's kind of disproportionate. They're in a way too tall with regards to vegetation, you know, as opposed to, say, a fir tree, which I think is a more beautiful plant, objectively, because the branches are more proportioned to the whole range of the trunk. But if you have a whole forest of redwoods, and they're all so vast compared to the human body, and there's such an incredible height, and they have that sort of residue of bark, and there's this quantitative complexity and density, and then the way they're all proportioned to each other in the forest, and they have a certain distance between each other, because each vital animal or plant takes up a certain amount of living space, and redwoods need a lot of living space. And then so you've got this proportion to the forest, and you're in there, and you're sort of in this maze of massive trees. It's beautiful. Okay, so there's a kind of integrity and proportion and splendor.
And then if you move up the chain to animal life, so you could take I'm taking a simple example and maybe even more noble example each time, the cat. There's a cat, he's a very well-known cat in the Dominican Order. He lives in the Priory in Cambridge, England, and his name is Leo. And he's a little white cat who has, he looks like, he's got some Chinese origin. He's got long fur, so he looks like a little lion. And he believes as much as cats can have beliefs, that he owns the Priory. So he breaks into your room and you go in and he's like lying on the bed and he looks at you like, what are you doing here? But I mean, Leo is, you can find him online, by the way. If you put Leo, the cat, Cambridge, Blackfriars. Anyway, he is a magnificent animal. I mean, he's a small animal and he's something of a pest, but he is glorious looking. And I mean, and he looks, you know, you talk about like a cat, think about animal shelters that house cats that have been harmed, okay? So the integrity of the animal has somehow been maimed. And then people have compassion on the cat and they try to rehabilitate the cat. But the thing is that there's a certain proportion between the features of the cat that make it more beautiful or that show you it suffered violence, that its integrity has been harmed. Animal integrity is, you know, we would maybe put that first in maybe moral categories of people who've been inhumane to the cat. Let's say not acted in a very human way towards their own animality and the way they act towards the animal. But there's also a certain way in which they've made the animal unbeautiful. And you might say there are more, maybe there are degrees of nobility and beauty among animals. So like the horse is a maybe more noble form of animal. There is a certain, it's hard to explain exactly, but I mean, there's a certain kind of beauty to the proportion of the horse, the power, maybe it's the power of the horse and the gracefulness of it in its movements. And movement is, again, a kind of quantitative proportion. You know, the proportionate movements of the horse when it and its capacities. And it, I think it evokes in us a sense of respect, fear, but also respect for the majesty and power of the horse. So there's a certain beauty in the sleekness and the mobility and power of an animal like that. When we come to human beings, we could talk about all those features we've just enumerated as insofar as we're animals and physical things, but then think about the two spiritual faculties, the intellect and the will. We could talk about people having, there's that movie, A Beautiful Mind. I mean, we can read an author, we could think about a treatise of philosophy or theology and say, that is a beautiful idea. That person has a beautifully ordered mind. Look at how beautiful that book is, or the argument of Aristotle concerning the virtue of magnanimity in the Nicomachean Ethics is like a beautiful argument. He shows like what it is to will greatness for others and for oneself that is neither proud nor false modesty. For example, the beauty of a virtue as Aristotle understands it. But then there's the beauty of the virtues themselves. Malcolm Muggeridge wrote that beautiful book about Mother Teresa, Something Beautiful for God. And I think most of us would say, well, her life was beautiful. But that's an interesting claim. I mean, she spends her time taking care of people who are dying in circumstances that are usually as far from aesthetic as possible. Working for the Mission to Charity is often very challenging in terms of aesthetics. You know, it's transcending often what are the ugliness of death in order to show compassion. But there's intensive moral beauty. There's intensive moral beauty, and then we could talk about the way that the lives of the saints manifest the beauty of charity, the beauty of love, how the love of God makes us beautiful interiorly,
and that the most interior beauty is the beauty of the love of God, and that there is nothing more beautiful than the love of God. Okay, so you can talk about moral beauty. Again, that's why you say, well, how? Just to illustrate the principle, why is that person's love of God beautiful? Well, it has an integrity to it, meaning it has a wholeness. It seizes their whole being. What I like about her is there's a certain kind of way in which she's given her whole life to God. There's an integrity to her love for God, a perfection, a wholeness. And it's proportionate. Like, she has a way of living out her love of God in everything she does, trying to. She seeks to, in humility, as best she can. And it's splendid. It's a hidden splendor, but it's something splendid. And Mother Teresa, it wasn't so hidden. It was, like, manifestly splendid. Okay? So, Aquinas is incredible. I mean, that's why they call me Angelic Doctor, because these definitions work for everything. You start pulling the thread, and you realize you can pass through all of reality by pulling this thread. So now let me talk about, let me mention God. Aquinas does say very clearly in the commentary on the divine names of Dionysius the Areopagite, I have it here in Latin, from the divine beauty, everything is derived. All that is derived from divine beauty. So this is a mystery. We don't really have direct access to the divine nature. But because God has made things that are always beautiful in some way, according to a gradated hierarchy of forms and different kinds of things, the one who has given all things being must be himself in some way underived beauty. There's an integrity to the divine nature that is hidden from us. We don't perceive it directly. We can infer philosophically that God is beautiful because God has this splendid perfection of his eternal nature, that God has this wisdom and goodness that we could call, by a kind of analogy, proportionately beautiful. There's something, we perceive the beauty of God's wisdom and goodness in the proportionate, the proportions of the things he's created. The world he's created has certain kind of internal order to it, an order of beauty and goodness and wisdom. And in that we perceive it kind of is as an effect of God's magnificent beauty that has given us being, given us existence. And there's a splendor to God. God is splendid. And this is most manifest to us in that God became human. Now, in the supernatural domain, what's amazing, this definition always works, when you move into, also talking about mysteries of the faith. So the incarnation, there's a certain integrity or perfection to Christ, who is the God-man. It's a perfection of humanity. He's the most perfect human being. He's more human than we are. He's the most human of us. But Christ is also divine, and there's the perfection of the divine nature present in him. And then this is present in his miracles, in his teachings, in his suffering, in his moral virtues, in his resurrection, and in and through all this proportionate activity of Christ, manifesting the beauty of God in the perfection of human nature, there's a splendor. Christ is splendidly beautiful in the perfection of his humanity and the perfection of his divinity, in the things he does and in the things he suffers, in his death and in his resurrection. There's a splendid beauty in all that he is. The infinite beauty of God is unveiled for us in the human face of Christ. And I give you a beautiful definition, a little thing from Hans Urs Balthasar here, which I won't read to you, but it's just a magnificent little statement about beauty from the theological aesthetics. Now, let me turn to the arts. The arts mirror and illustrate the reality of beauty. You might call them arts, formalizing mirrors. What do I mean by formalizing mirrors? Well, in some ways, the artist tries to reflect the beauty of the world. So in some ways, the art is always second-order beauty. Second-order beauty, that doesn't sound very complimentary. But in another way, it's a formalization of the beautiful that the mind is capable of because of its spiritual nature. So the artist, because he or she can grasp something of the beauty of the world and then transform it through the artistic process, can place in a kind of raw clarity the beauty of the world through an intellectual formalization. It's just like this, I mean, analogously. Take the geometer. You can see intimations of pure circles in nature, but they're never as pure as the geometer's circle. Why? Because the geometer has formalized the circle more perfectly, using the intellectual property of abstraction and human instrument civilization. So you don't find perfect circles in nature as much as you do in the work of the geometer. And the artist is like this with regards to beauty. They take adumbrations of beauty in the world, and they're second order in that they don't create the way God creates. They have to, the artist is always, to put it negatively, a bit of a parasite, because they have to work from God's more beautiful, more fundamental beautiful creation, and they formalize. But Dante says the artist is the grandchild of God. That's a much more complimentary way of putting it. It's like the artist is like the little child is playing in the presence of the grandfather and formalizing beauty. He can't make the world, but in the world God made, he can give chant and praise to the greatness of beauty by his or her formalizations of beauty. So
let's look at...
No, it's still okay. Let's look at seven of the seven, you know, fine arts briefly, and think about how this happens. We can. Why are there diverse arts? Well, because the human being is very complicated. I mean, we have different sensations. So first of all, we're animals. So we have five senses, and then we have rational animal, intellectual animal with intellect and will. So we can formalize beauty by, as it were, different pathways of encountering it. So take painting. Obviously, painting is visual. So it presumes sight. It's not audible. Pure painting is not audible. And what does painting try to capture? Defining the arts, by the way, is hard. I mean, when you read people who write about them, the definitions are more nebulous. It's not so easy. But one could argue that the painter tries to give a perspective on the whole in the visual order. So, I mean, he's always trying to show you a visual unity, whether it's a person, a figure, whether it's a landscape. And then there's the use of symbols instantiated in individuals, which gives it a conceptuality. Painting is a very intellectual art because it instantiates invisible singulars, symbols of deeper concepts or universals. And at the same time, there's a tension between that and color, because the artist could just, if they want, explore the dynamism of visual quality. If you think like Miro or Jackson Pollock, Jackson Pollock is just exploring the kind of quality and the quantitative proportions of color. Some people think that's a bad thing. I love it. I mean, and it's dense, it's physical, but okay, we can moralize about Jackson Pollock in the Q&A if you want. But the point is, it's not wrong for artists to explore quality, pure quality, raw quality, in proportionate harmonies. But they can also do visual symbols, and they can ally these two things to give you a perspective on the whole. If you think about, it's a funny painting, but if you think about Picasso's Guernica, which is like showing you the Spanish Civil War, it's an incredibly moving picture, attempting to symbolically visualize the horror of the Spanish Civil War. Music. Music is different not only because it's audible, but also because it only occurs in time. You might think about music as a little world of time. In music, we explore a little world of time which has its own unity, not the time of our whole lives, not the time of a whole day, but the time of 10 minutes or the time of an hour. And we enter into the unity of that time and we let it affect us emotionally. And we make an alliance with music in terms of allying ourselves in terms of feeling its internal duration in us, rhythm, life, emotion. And it can be more or less spiritual or more or less filled with emotional pathos. You know, the Rolling Stones, Painted Black, is very different than the Requiem of Mozart. And they're both music, they're both very absorbed, they have a great absorptional power, both of them, but one of them is far more in the passions, as Plato says. It kind of devolves the person if you get addicted to it as raw emotion. And at the same time, the other is meant to elevate. And I think Gregorian chant is, you know, stereotypical for monks defending Gregorian chant, but I think Gregorian chant does have this very unique capacity to elevate the mind, to think on spiritual things through the medium of a duration, according to a rhythm of emotional and internal life of the human animal that allows us to contemplate God. But in any case, music is this kind of, there's a kind of
perfection of a wholeness of a piece of music, the proportion of the notes, the quantitative arrangement of them, the harmonies of the qualities, see, the proportion of qualities and quantity, and the splendor of the music. So it's there again. Sculpture. Sculpture is showing the human body in its spiritual beauty. In a way, sculpture freezes and spiritualizes the body in significant meaning. The obvious example here again, Michelangelo's Pieta and the face of Mary, accepting in her fiat, with her hand out, the death of the Son. It's like taking a spiritual sentiment of the highest, most noble kind and impressing it in marble to show the dignity of the human body of Mary. And it sits there for centuries. And dance is almost the exact opposite, because it's immersion in the movement of the body. And so where you spiritualize the body in sculpture, dance, you sort of move with your human freedom, you embrace with your human freedom the movement of the body. And so you show this, you do show the capacity of the body, if you talk about ballet or something like more noble forms of dance, you do show the capacity of the body of the spirit, the mind, for mastery of the body in incredible ways. Or if you think about, like, analogously, the techniques of the Olympic, well, you know, like, a lot of gymnastics is a kind of dance. And there's an incredible mastery of the body, but it's a mastery through movement. And what we admire especially is the freedom of the artist to be able to express themselves in and through that movement. And it shows something of the dignity of the body in and through time. Again, dance, unlike sculpture, it's temporal. So it's about how to live in your body in time, or what the body means as a body of a free person in time. Poetry and literature explores the singularity of universal interior experience of the world. That's to say, my experience of loving the world. Poetry is about the fleetingness and the richness of human loves in their singularity, captured in almost in language that allows you to say what is almost intangible or unspeakable. The greatness of a poet is that they can say something about a human love or a human perception of reality that is very difficult to say, and that is resonates deeply with us universally. So there's something, poetry is very powerful. It's closest to philosophy, arguably. Heidegger has this saying, poetry casts light on being. Poetry casts light on being. Because it helps you see what it is to be as a human being perceiving the world in love. And that's why often poetry, the subject of poetry is insight, possession, loss, nostalgia, hope. Drama, I would say, is about the unfolding of human decisions with regards to good and evil in time. The consequences of our acts. If you want to look at what does drama explore? The consequences of our moral actions. The unity of a play is always, if you think about the perfection of a play, it always puts in light the gravity of a human choice and the consequences of it and the unfolding of it. And that's why, typically, for example, tragedy is paradigmatic of drama. Because you look at how, I don't know, Oedipus Rex's decisions or Antigone's decisions change their whole life in some way, and then there's a tragic cycle of events that unfold, and the dignity of the human person is made manifest in and through the consequences of the tragedy that unfolds before you, or something like that. And lastly, architecture. Now, architecture is practical. I mean, it's to create a place for human life together. But it does give expression to the shared human meaning of inhabited space. In America, most of our architecture is functional. And that tells you something about what we think of as constituting our human relationships. Financial transactions and the practical care of our bodies. I mean, if you're in a, God willing, this never is just a fictional example, but if you're in an accident on your way home and you're taken to a hospital, you know, in an emergency room, you're not going, well, the architecture in here is not right for me somehow. No, I mean, we want to make sure there are oxygen masks, and this is a good place to operate on you if you're hemorrhaging internally. Right? So that's fine, but you don't have to build the architecture of the entire culture on that model.
the hospital Walmart model.
That said, it's a great investment of time and resources to build things more beautifully. Okay, so, but architecture can bespeak the sublimity and transcendence of God, as in sacred architecture. It can facilitate the life of the mind. I was recently visiting Princeton Theological Seminary and went in their new library. It is magnificent. If I had my way, I would move there. I would live in the third floor. The collection is great. It would be great to make a priory, but we're a few steps short of the takeover. But you know, it's filled with light. It's a beautiful place to study. It's a great architectural success of modern architecture for the purpose of what it is, a library meant where people can quietly study the mystery of God. Okay, I'm going to finish here. The plane is approaching the runway. Do not despair. So I've given you a quote from Benedict XVI from his address to artists in 2009, where he speaks about how the artists, insofar as they seek the absolute truth of things, to mirror the truth of things in these seven diverse ways I've just mentioned, explore the meaning of reality itself. So there's a way in which it's not just mirroring and formalizing, but it's attempting to trace and have insight into the meaning of reality. That's why the greatest works of art are works of art that allow us to, in some way, begin to perceive the meaning of the whole, and here the integrity or the perfection of the whole is really everything. The greatest of artists try to speak in their art about the meaning of everything, and about the proportions between elements of reality, and about the splendor and maybe also the dark shades of obscurity and evil in reality. That, by the way, that definition I just gave could work for an atheist artist. But it's not surprising that you will find that as art tries to work toward a kind of perspective on the whole, this often happens in poetry and literature. But it happens certainly in music, when you especially if you think about the operatic, that you begin to try to speak reality, and it's very natural in a way that the artist should then begin to speak about reality in light of God. Think about Hamlet, where you try to have someone say something massive about reality in light of morality and God and human affairs and marriage and love and death, or obviously the Divine Comedy of Dante. But also you could think about, I always heard people say War and Peace is the greatest novel ever written. I'm not going to read it because everybody says it's the greatest novel ever written and it must be terrible, and then I read it. This is probably the best novel I've ever read. Tolstoy's capacity to denote reality is amazing, and the exploration of the meaning of human existence in light of God in the face of the Napoleonic Wars in Russia is an incredibly profound portrait of reality. There was debate in the 20th century, especially about opera, as potentially the most perfect form of art, denoted by some theorists as total art. Why? Because you get every one of the seven arts. Obviously, there's architecture in the background. There's poetry and literary significance given to the meaning of life. There's music. There's dance. There's sculpture on the set and costumes. So you have a kind of a totality to it. And so you could argue that in something like opera, you attempt to put all the art forms together and to produce a totality of art in the service of an account of the totality of the meaning of human existence. Now, if you go and listen to Don Giovanni or La Boheme, and you print out the transcript in English, you read it like, well, this is not the meaning of life. These guys are not. They're having a lot of fun. This is really pretty. I mean, they're exploring all the virtualities of the human voice. That's what this is. And there's lots of melodrama and everybody dies. It's great. But this is not the meaning of life. But you can imagine, there are operas that have really great profundity. And there are moments in almost every great opera that have really great profundity. And so it's an interesting idea. I don't know if I want to defend opera's total art. What I want to do is transition the idea that in another way,
liturgy is total art, but maybe not total art as much as a totalizing form of beauty. Why? Well, I want to go back to the list of the hierarchy of being, of the beauty of reality, where I talked about the beauty of the truth and a well-ordered mind, the beauty of philosophy, the beauty of theological truth, and the beauty of moral nobility, the beauty of charity. And I want to say that in liturgy, when it's totally perfect or approaches perfection, you have the beauty of the arts. Certainly, you could talk about the beauty of architecture, you could talk about definitely the beauty of poetry and preaching, the beauty of the poetic texts of not only scripture or the teachings and truths of scripture, but also the prayers of the sacred liturgy, of the canon of the Mass, and of the texts of hymns, the music that's engaged. But also you have the beauty of the truth of Christ preached, of Christ present Eucharistically, the beauty of the form of Christ on the altar, that the very God-man who saved us is present by transubstantiation in the Mass. The Eucharist is obscure. It's an obscure mystery of faith, but he's really present, and he is beautiful. The Eucharist is beautiful. It's obscure, but very beautiful in the faith, spiritually beautiful. The mind can contemplate and admire the radiant and hidden presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And you have the moral nobility of Christ's charity and the charity of the church who love Christ, of she who responds to Christ in the Mass, collectively worshiping him, praising him, and being drawn into unity with him. And you could talk about the beauty of the saints, the beauty of those whose lives are most deeply irradiated by the beauty of Christ, and whose lives take on the form of his charity, that perfection and integrity, that proportionality, and that splendor of the charity of Christ that lives in those who eat his body and drink his blood. So we can conclude by asking the question, can beauty save the world? And let me say this. I would reformulate the statement and say, well, only God can save us. But when God saves the world, salvation is beautiful. Why? Because God works through wisdom and goodness, his wisdom and goodness, and therefore the truth of God is at work in our salvation, and the truth of God is attractive, the splendor of the form, the beauty of the truth, the goodness of the truth that attracts us. Okay? So when God saves us, his salvation is true and good and therefore beautiful. So we can speak of the goodness of the divine truth, the splendor of the truth of Christ. And this beauty of Christ is reflected in his human life among us, in his death and resurrection, in his beautiful teaching, in the beauty of the church, in the beauty of her liturgy and the sacraments, in the beauty of human reverence for God, and in the beauty of the supernatural faith of believers, and in the beautiful sanctity of charity. The lives of the saints are beautiful because they are good and true with the truth and goodness of Christ. And so God also draws people through beauty to himself, but he draws them to himself within beauty by grace. It is the grace of Christ that saves the world, and that grace is beautiful. Thank you very much. So we're going to take 10 minutes or so for questions.
Great lecture. My question is, why would it, I'm driving past a dilapidated building that's falling apart so it doesn't have integrity, or if I'm watching like a demolition video, why is that, what's the appetible part of that?
Yeah, okay, so I think people heard it, but when you see things that have dilapidated integrity, like a house breaking down, or you see a house being demolished, monster truck videos. Why do people like watching the big truck crush the Toyota? It's not patriotism. I mean, the latter is easier. I mean, it's obviously power. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it's, you know, just like talking about the power of the horse, you know. I was bitten by enough horses as a child that I stayed very far away from them. But I mean, there's something magnificent. We go horse riding in Wyoming or something, you know, the magnificent sort of power of the horse. And I think a lot of forms of artificial technology are, in ways that are, they're fine, they're attractive because of their power. And the capacity also to see it effectuated. But the dilapidated house is more difficult. And it's, I think it has to do with the fact that it illustrates, well, for me, I mean, I grew up in Southeast Georgia, so there's stuff rotting everywhere, covered with kudzu, you know, farmhouses falling apart. You're driving down remote highways where there's nothing but one country music station and two kinds of trees, and you're seeing dilapidated farms all around you. And my take on that is the nostalgia of lost time, is that you see the incompleteness of your own world because there was a world that came before you, and you see the lingering reality of that world. And I think it has to do with the human memory or the human imagination. It's a kind of poetic experience of the passing of time, of loss and nostalgia. Well, of course, that's a very Southern thing to say, but I mean, I think that that's at least how we affects many of us, or at least my generation, because you saw a whole world, really, of agricultural, rural, Southern life gone and replaced by a much more successful economic model that's far less beautiful. So I think that there's ways in which we measure the passage of time through the transmission of artifacts from one era to another.
You give a lot of room for kind of personal need and personal concepts of art, it seemed like. The hospital room that's befitting the surgery, or the artist appreciating one particular color or examining one particular form of art. How do you then defend against the person that says, well, the kind of art that is most beneficial for me, or is most fulfilling for me, is the dumb covered Madonna, or the some sort of other artificial art, something we would generally reject?
That's a great question. How do you try to create criteria of ugliness, and what's contrary to sacrality, things that are actually deeply spiritually ugly, and then the exaltation of the spiritually ugly through the use of the aesthetic form. I think part of it is, this is a very stock answer for Dominican, but without metaphysics, it's gonna be pretty hard. In other words, I think you need a really robust theory of what human personhood is, about being and about God. And when you have a culture that loses those things philosophically, then the hierarchies all get inverted, and we need to destroy things that were valued before. I mean, a great example is Nietzsche. If you take the book The Gay Science, with the famous passage where he talks about the madman going out with the lantern into the civilization, modern European civilization, saying, "Have you heard God is dead? Have you heard God is dead?" It's actually Nietzsche. I don't think Nietzsche's, maybe I'm going to say something controversial here, I don't think he's a great literary artist. But I think that is a great literary passage. It's beautiful, just as literature. It's incredibly profound. And it's an incredibly profound statement of atheism, which I take to be massively metaphysically erroneous. So I think often here you get into the problem of false seductions. Because of the range of things that are beautiful, you can exalt lesser things, like the greatness of artistic freedom and human autonomy of the Superman, over and against things that seem maybe glib, like bourgeois European Victorian morality, but behind which there's actually something maybe more fundamental, like the reality of God or the reality of Christ. You know, so it goes very far. I mean, if you read Nietzsche's Antichrist, it's a really powerful book, and there's some beautiful things in it, and he is exalting in beautiful ways real features of human existence, but he's, I think, deeply metaphysically disoriented. And the only way to put that right is to get metaphysically oriented. So I don't think something less than a very deep philosophical perception of reality gives you the sufficient warrant to set right an idea about the hierarchy of beauty.
As a sort of recapitulation, perhaps you can comment on last week your brother Dominic and Anselm Ramelow presented at the JP2 Institute a discussion of the transcendentals.
Yeah.
Talked about in the order of logic, being is the foundation of all reality. And beauty, he said, is the foundation stone. And beauty is the capstone.
Yes.
The capstone transcendental. So
that's exactly what I was arguing. That's nice to know. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of debate about that in Thomism. There's people who claim beauty is not a transcendental, but I think Aquinas, if you say that God is beautiful, and the beauty of God is the origin of all that exists, and then you say that anything that is, insofar as it is, has a certain truth and a certain goodness to it, then it seems to me you're having to conclude that there's some kind of beauty in all things, insofar as they're produced by the transcendent beauty of God. But as Aquinas articulates the order, beauty is foundational for the perception of unity, which is foundational for the perception of intelligibility and goodness. And then from intelligibility and goodness, you get truth. I mean, beauty.
I have a question about this applying to the problem of pain, because I think the classic answer to the problem of pain is that ultimately God brings a greater good and evil. Is there a greater integrity of something that is broken and then brought back into integral?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question, really hard question. The problem of pain. Pain seems like a lack. Often pain and suffering are the sign of a deep lack of integrity in us, you know. I mean, some evil is done to a human being, or we suffer a great illness, there's a lack of perfection of the form of being human. And then the question becomes, well, could God bring greater good out of the evil that has been suffered, and therefore redeem that reality by a yet greater beauty? And that is the Christian claim. There are different registers to the way you articulate that, though. I mean, you might say philosophically, the most you can say is, if you really get high, it's a philosopher standing on the high shelf, and he reaches really high up conceptually, he can begin to see there's a spiritual soul. It's at the edge of human rationality to be able to see it, but it's there. Most modern philosophers don't, they blink when you affirm that. But that is the classical argument, and I think it's correct. Say we have a spiritual soul. So there's a certain rational intelligibility of believing the soul can suffer virtuously in the face even of death. And that's, of course, the archetypal example in philosophy is Socrates, who dies to bear witness to the city, to the nobility of moral truth. And so even the pain inflicted upon him is redeemable for Plato, because his soul goes to the absolute good of God. So there's a certain way, even philosophically, you can hope that a greater good will come from witness to the truth in the midst of suffering. It's not a philosophically indefensible claim. But obviously on another register, it really has to be in reference to Christ that we resolve the mystery of the problem of suffering, evil, death, and pain. And that has to do with a yet, to quote you, or you quoted, you alluded to C.S. Lewis, but I can do that in response to you in terms of the line of the witch in the wardrobe. And no, I don't mean tauntingly, I mean like it's nice how it parallels, it's proportionate. And talk about when, Aslan is slain, and then what the White Witch didn't know about was the yet deeper beauty that's in the deeper magic that's in the world when Aslan is resurrected. And the resurrection shows us the sort of deeper magic, or if you like, deeper beauty of a mystery of proportionate integrity in all things that will be drawn into the resurrection of Christ, and the way that human suffering and even the bearing with evils, not only natural but moral evils, for the sake of the love of Christ, can become a way we achieve union with Christ in glory. Now that's a hope in faith, but we know it's true in the certitude of supernatural faith, but if it's true, it is the most beautiful thing in the world, and it is the definitive answer insofar as we have an answer in this world to how to orient ourselves in suffering and pain towards something yet more beautiful.